than think of in Iran today. In the last few years, his work has become fairly widely known outside Iran, but at the same time, his writings are only now starting to be translated into English. He's known to non-Persian speakers, in other words, mainly through commentaries on his work, rather than through people having been able to read his work, or indeed to have the opportunity to hear him talk. So I think we're extremely lucky indeed to have him today to talk to us. Perhaps his best known writings are those concerned with the theoretical expansion and contraction of the Sharia, Abdul Bast, dating from about 10 years ago. The title which he's going to talk to today is Islam and Pluralism, but I have a feeling he may also be reflecting for us on his theoretical expansion contraction theory as well. I think without further ado, I will ask Dr. Sarouche to address us.
Shall I stand? Or
no.
Just
well, I think
everybody can hear me, I think. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thanks all of the respectable audience who are here, and I am extremely delighted.
It is possible to stand.
That would be better, huh?
I can hear people doing that in the background.
Yeah,
sorry,
I mean,
we don't have an amplification.
Well, you have to cope with it, because my voice is always soft, and so this may not be cured in one session. So anyway, I will be... The subject which I would like to present here will be very brief and very simple. Of course, I have to draw on some historical materials in order to make my case as clear as possible. Nevertheless, the whole issue of the Islam and pluralism, I hope, will be clarified by the end of this very cordial and friendly lecture, I would say. Now, the story, of course, goes back to perhaps more than 10 years ago, that's 30 years ago, I would say, when I became for the first time familiar with Rumi, the most important and the most popular mystic poet of Iran and the Persian language. Of course, this remarkable man needs no further introduction. I mean, those who are familiar with Persian literature, with Islamic literature, will know him very well. He was one of the greatest mystic poets, and to me, he was the seal of all mystics in our history, and his important book, which is called Masnavi, is still being read, being studied, and being commented on it. And fortunately, there is a very good translation of the book in English by Nicholson, who translated it about 60 years ago, and it is now available. And so those people who do not know him very well or who have not heard of him better go to the work and to make familiar for themselves. So that was the starting point for me to think seriously and in earnest about pluralism. Of course, the idea or perhaps even the word or the concept of pluralism was not familiar to me at that time. Definitely in Iran we did not really talk and write about pluralism, especially religious pluralism. But by and by, when I continued my study on Rumi, and then I became familiar with Hafiz and all other Persian poets and thinkers, of late I embarked on the theory of expansion and contraction of religious knowledge, or Sharia, as Professor Tapper mentioned. And there actually I was able to recruit all what I had learned before through Rumi and Hafiz and all other thinkers, and then in order to combine them and to formulate them in a new way, and to lay the foundations not only for religious or Islamic pluralism, but also for a kind of religious or Islamic democracy. In brackets, I would like to mention here that for a religious democracy, we need two pillars. One is the religious pluralism, which I think I have laid the foundation for, and I am going to give you a brief explanation, exposition of that. And then we need, of course, another theory, which is the theory for the human rights. For that theory, of course, we need a new theory or a new philosophy of man. There we have to lay the foundation for human rights, and then we have to combine it with the theory of religious pluralism in order to have both pillars of a religious democracy. So far, we have been able, I would say, in our country, me and my colleagues who work together, to provide a theory for the religious pluralism. As to the second pillar, of course, we are working, and that is, of course, altogether a different issue, a different story, which has to be told elsewhere. Now, as to the religious pluralism, of course, we not only draw on the Western literature and on the writings of the thinkers here, but also we have got a very, very precious treasure of the mystical poetry and mystical thinking in our own tradition. And there, of course, we can get a lot of good and important and useful ideas in order to provide a theory for religious pluralism. Mysticism has been always a source of tolerance, but this tolerance, of course, has got to have a theoretical basis. Otherwise, it would be an emotional thing which will go away very easily and simply. So, in mysticism, you can find a theory for tolerance. And this theory is basically a theory of pluralistic thinking about religions. Rumi and Hafiz, who are two main sources for me, who are two main personalities from whom I have learned a lot about religious pluralism, their theories or their visions about pluralism, of course, are different. One of them I would call a positive view of pluralism, and the other one I would call the negative. In Rumi, of course, you have got the idea that since we have got a host of truths, since there are the accumulation of truths, because of the interwovenness of truth everywhere, because of the multidimensionality of reality, we have to have a pluralism. He mentions this issue of 72 sectarian groups in Islam, as you are familiar with. There is a tradition coming from Prophet. It may not be that authentic, but nevertheless it is very widely held by all Muslims, that after the Prophet, Muslims actually divided into 72 groups. Now, Rumi tells us that these 72 groups were the result of the multidimensionality of the religious truth. That is his idea, which I call it positive pluralism. Since we are rich, since reality is very rich enough, since there are different aspects to reality, to truth, therefore we become pluralistic, i.e. our understanding of reality will become inevitably diverse. So I will look at one dimension of the fact of truth or reality, you will look at another angle, and therefore we come, the outcome will be different explanation and different visions of the same reality. This is because of the richness of the reality that a pluralism becomes inevitable. And the people who are wise enough, who are clever enough, and who try to understand the reality, they will, necessarily have different ideas because of the multidimensionality of the reality. Now, in Hafiz, you have got a different view altogether. He thinks that these 72 sections or sects in Islam, they are there because of our ignorance of the truth. He says that since they did not see the truth, since they were innocent of truth, therefore they became 72 sects. His is a negative pluralism. Since we do not know the truth, since it is beyond our reach, since it is inaccessible, therefore out of ignorance we become diverse, we conflict, and the confrontations arise among us. So we have got two kinds of pluralism, and both come from our mystics, and both has got their basis in reality. In fact, of course, conflict among people actually stems from two different sources, and roughly one is because of the richness of the truth, and the other is because of our ignorance of the truth. So these two sources, we had it, and actually I noticed it in the literature and the tradition of mystical thinkers. Now, when I embarked on the theory of contraction and expansion of religious knowledge, there actually I try to define and perhaps to rediscover a new source for religious pluralism. And that was this. Now, there I tried to separate religion on the one hand and the interpretation of the religion on the other hand. This seemingly Kantian position proved very useful in understanding the religion and in drawing very major consequences out of this particular simple separation of two different things. We have got on the one hand the text, and on the other hand, of course, we have got the interpretation of the text. And these two, of course, should be kept separate. And their attributes are necessarily different. Now, interpretations are always in flux, and they are contingent upon your pre-assumptions. And where your pre-assumptions change, definitely and inevitably, your interpretation of the text will change. I was not at the time actually aware of the theory of the death of author, which is now very prevalent and it is everywhere and it is in vogue, and I was not aware of the theories of interpretation which Gadamer and other philosophers actually had put forward. But at the end actually I came to know that our views were very convergent actually, and the theory of the death of author is something which I advocate and I second, and I think that is one of the consequences of the theory of expansion and contraction of religious knowledge. Now, you have got the interpretation of the text, and the interpretation will never be final, will never be real in the sense that the true interpretation of the text is unattainable, and you have to have always an authentic, a possible authentic interpretation, and that is all. No more than that you will gain through the interpretation, and of course it is always provisional, it is always temporal, and it is always tentative and hypothetical, and it is always, of course, non-official. I mean, you cannot have any official interpretation of religion, and by that actually I discarded and rejected any ideological interpretation of religion, because ideology means a final and official interpretation of the school of thought, and when you have the theory of the non-finality or the tentativeness of the interpretation, therefore all ideological interpretations of religion will be inevitably rejected. So here we have got the theory of plurality of interpretations, which is inevitable, and it is one of the requirements of the theory of expansion and contraction. Here actually I found another basis for religious pluralism, and that is this, that religious pluralism is based on the plurality of the interpretation of the text, and since that is proved, therefore you cannot force any body or any community in order to accept a particular definite interpretation of religion. So people are free, and they have to be let free in order to have their own interpretations of the scriptures. Of course, there are criteria and there are all sorts of principles in order to be observed. Nevertheless, having those criteria and having the principles of interpretation, you will come to different conclusion and to different interpretation. And this is a fact of history, and this is the logic of interpretation, which is unavoidable. So here you have got another basis, another foundation for religious pluralism. Another reason for this pluralism, can we have one of these windows open, because it's I am talking, but these people are listening to me, so we are different here. Thank you. Now, the as you know, religion is not only based on the text, on the interpretation of the text, but is also based on the religious experience. And this is something that recently most of the philosophers of religion have turned to and have taken it as the basis of religious belief. So in the past, of course, religious experience was supposed to be confined to prophets who used to receive revelations and who used to interpret the revelation for their followers. But now, of course, there is a tendency towards expanding the idea of religious experience, and there is a tendency to say that perhaps different people in different denominations, different religions, can receive some kind of revelation. This revelation, of course, is not prophetic revelation. Nevertheless, the best name to be used here is the expression religious experience. Now, this religious experience is there also in the mystical tradition of all religions, including Islamic tradition. Our mystics, including Rumi, which I mentioned, whom I mentioned before, and many others, they have explicitly talked about the religious experience of the believers. And they have explicitly used the word revelation, wahy in Arabic, for this kind of religious experience. And they have not avoided using it. Of course, they have explained the real meaning of the term. Nevertheless, they were of the opinion that we can receive revelation, we can have religious experience, and the mystical religious experience is the best basis for religious belief. You might get, you might receive your religious belief through scriptures. You might be a mere follower, a mere imitator, and receiving your ideas and your beliefs from your fathers, from your preacher, and you might receive your belief through your own personal religious experience. And this is the best. Now, prophets, of course, were prophets. We, as believers, as religious people, can follow our prophets. Following prophets has got different types. You may follow their orders, and you may follow their experience. And this second type of following the prophets is the best and the most important and the deepest way of becoming a believer. Now, if we take the religious experience as the basis of religious belief, then we come to the conclusion again that inevitably these religious experiences are diverse, are pluralistic, and they cannot be reduced to one single type of experience. Now, this is something which people do not pay enough attention to. And they, since in most of religious traditions, people usually do believe in something through tradition and through respect for their clergy and for the ulama and so on. They do not take it very seriously, but once you want to enter, to step in the field of the religion seriously and in earnest, you will find religious experience the most important source of religious belief, of the kind of relationship you would like to have with your Creator, and a better understanding of the religion you believe in. So the diversity of religious experience also is another source for religious pluralism. They cannot be, and they are not, to be reduced to one particular type of experience. Now, to sum up, these are different sources. On the one hand, you have got negative pluralism. On the other hand, you have got the positive pluralism. Negative one is based on the ignorance of the truth. Positive pluralism is based on the richness of the truth. And then you have got the text and the interpretation of the text, which is logically, I mean, by the logic of interpretation, is pluralistic. You cannot reduce interpretations of a particular text into one and only one. You have to cope with different and diverse interpretations. And then you have got religious experience, which is in itself also a pluralistic in nature. So these three things gives you a pluralism of in religion. Now, what it means? This means that inevitably we will have and we should have different religions. After all, it was God Himself who created religious pluralism in the first place, because He sent different prophets, and He knew already that the followers of these different prophets will not actually reconcile, and the different religions are seemingly and apparently incompatible. And in the whole course of the history, there are a few Christians to become Muslims. There are few Muslims to become Christians. And everybody actually keeps his faith and tries to be what he is till the end of his life. So that was actually perhaps the plan of the creator of the world, the plan of the senders of the prophets. Perhaps that was his will for the people, to be different, to be diverse. Perhaps actually he respected the law of nature, and he knew that people seldom can lend themselves to conversion, to change their religion so easily. And because of all this, he must be the sole and the first planner of religious diversity and religious pluralism in the whole world of human beings. But this is not the only thing. In the history, you have got different prophets, as I said, and you have got different religions. They are irreducible to each other. And the conclusion of the premises which I put forward is this, that the diversity of religions is the logical consequence of the diversity of religious experience, of the diversity of interpretations of religious scriptures. So it has not been due to the conspiracy of any particular body or any particular community. It has not been due to the stubbornness or the resistance of the people to truth, and it has not been a devilish plan or through some satanic attachments of some people in order to resist the truth. That has not been the case. If you see different religions in the world, and if you see that there are people different, if you see that there are different interpretations of the same text, different religious experiences, you have to think that perhaps it is the requirements of the nature of the case that we have got it. So religious pluralism then shows itself as something very natural, very logical, and not only because of the ignorance of the truth in some cases, but also because of the richness of the truth in some other cases. Because after all, religion is encounter with the multidimensionality of the transcendental reality. Now, coming to terms with this multidimensionality gives you plurality and gives you diversity, which is unavoidable. So now, what this means? Does this mean that truth is relative? Does this mean that every and all religions are really true, and through every religion we can attain salvation? Does religious pluralism means that that we cannot have any false religion, any false invitation? Does religious pluralism means passivism in the case of religion? No invitation, no fighting for making other people's coming or accepting the truth. What does religious pluralism means? It is, of course, a fact of history, and it is the logic of the religious experience and the logic of the interpretation. So it is inevitable. We cannot escape it. And I think any logical person, anybody who follows the line of the religion in a scholarly way, rather than through a pure imitation, will understand that ideas are so diverse that even if you confine them to a very few, then you cannot reduce them to a single particular idea. This is very similar to the case in scientific theories. Of course, about every phenomenon in nature, you might have different theories. But as philosophers of science has taught us, I mean, theories can be reduced to a few, but usually they cannot be reduced to single one. Therefore, in every age, in every period of science, you will have the phenomena, and you have theories about the phenomena, and theories are always pluralistic and diverse. And a single particular theory about phenomena cannot be found. This is something which the history of philosophy of science also have taught us. So altogether, now, in order to relieve you, relativism of truth is besides the point. That is not our issue. What we talk about and what we think about is not the truth in itself, it's truth for us. Okay? So that is the main subject of the issue of religious pluralism or any other kind of pluralism. So the issues of postmodernity and relativism and truth and all that is beyond this discussion. I am not touching the truth in itself. I am not claiming that truth is relative. And actually, if you would like me to unveil my belief, this whole business of relativism or relativity of truth is a very dangerous truth itself, which has to be avoided. And I particularly do not subscribe to that idea, and I think that there are very good reasons to topple that idea, and we need it. But nevertheless, we should not engage ourselves in that debate, and my idea of pluralism, be it a scientific or a religious one, is not based on the plurality or the relativity of truth in itself. It is based on the idea of plurality or relativity of truth for us. Because after all, truth is something which is related to us. If we do not take into consideration our connection with truth, truth will become reality. Reality is a different thing. But when we have some kind of relationship of connection with the reality, then the idea and the whole issue of truth and falsity will arise. I am talking about truth for us, not truth for in itself. And truth for us, of course, is relative. There I do subscribe to the relativity of truth, and it is really relative, because when you look at the reality from this angle and another one looks at the reality from another angle, they will come to different conclusion, and this is very logical and very natural. Suffice it to be consistent. I mean, of course, relative truth also should be consistent. We cannot cope with an inconsistent system of truth, inconsistent system of ideas. All truths are familiar, all truths are friends, and all truths are consistent. Inconsistency means contradiction, and means that there is some sort of falsity which has penetrated, infiltrated into your system, and you have to be aware of that. But once you have got a consistent system, then you can be sure that at least you are nearer to truth, and you can follow it up in order perhaps to get closer and closer to truth. Therefore, the idea of relativity of the truth for us here is at stake, and we subscribe to it, but not the idea of the relativity of truth in itself. Second point is this, that in the case of religion, the whole meaning of truth is really different from the meaning of truth in the case of science and in the case of philosophy, in the case of logic. This is something which I have seen that some of the philosophers of religion has overlooked. It is very important to take it into account that the concept of truth in religion, a true religion, I would say, is very different from a true scientific theory or a true philosophical theory. Truth in these two different areas actually means different things altogether. So a kind of fallacy is being committed here. There are philosophers, opponents of religious pluralism, opponent of scientific or philosophical pluralism, and their main argument is this, that since truth is one and only one, so we cannot have any pluralism in the case of truth. All pluralisms are because of the infiltration of the false ideas into your system. And once you eliminate those false ideas, you will have the single truth at the end, and that will be one and only one. Therefore, according to Hafez, of a mystic poet which I mentioned, all plurality, 72 different sects, arise, stem out of our ignorance of truth, or perhaps out of the falsities infiltrated into the system. But if you eradicate them, the system will be unique and not pluralistic. Now, what I would like to say is this, that here a fallacy is being committed which has to be avoided logically and philosophically. In the case of scientific and philosophical theories, yes, truth means correspondence with fact. So this is the theory. Of course, there are different definitions of truth, all of you are aware of, and I am not going to explain all those one by one, but this is by far the best and the widest accepted theory or definition of truth, correspondence with fact. Now, in the case of a theory of a scientific theory, of course, your theory is true when it corresponds with fact and is false when it does not. So that is very simple. And of course, to find the instance of a theory, true theory, is a different story. In philosophy, you have got the same thing. But in the case of religion, there we do not have this criterion of corresponding with fact. In the case of religions, let me give you an example in order to make my case as clear as possible. Now, according to Muslims, Christianity was a true religion until the time of the Prophet of Islam, when actually he came and he claimed that he was the next prophet. Then Christianity's period was over, and from then on Christianity was no longer a valid religion, so to speak, and Islam became a valid one. According to Christians, Judaism was a valid or a true religion until the rise of the Christ, and from then on Judaism was no longer a valid religion. Therefore, the validity of religions is more important for the believers than the truth. Here, the issue of truth is not being involved. That is altogether beyond the point. So this has to be taken into account in order for the pluralism in religion to be understood as deep as possible. Here, truth is not important, because truth is truth. It is universal. It has no history. I mean, the sphericality of the earth was a truth. Supposedly, it was a true idea, not only after Copernicus, not only after Galileo, but even before them. When it was not even discovered, it was still a truth. So truth has no history. You cannot say that something is true to some point. But in the case of religions, and according to the believers of religions, and my addressee here are the true believers actually, they think that the validity of religions is something temporal, is something provisional. A particular religion is valid until the rise of the next prophet. Then it will be invalid. That its time and its validity will be over. And this is not the case with the logical or with scientific truth. Scientific truth is ahistorical. It is beyond history. It is not hypothetical. Philosophical truth is ahistorical. But religious truth is historical. And there we better talk of validity rather than truth. Truth is better kept for logic, for science, for philosophy, and all that. But here we better talk of religious validity or right. Now, validity in the case of religion has got something to do with right, and right has got something to do with duty. This needs some explanation. A religion, a particular religion, is valid. And when it is valid, it is your duty as a believer to subscribe to that particular religion. When you come to discover that a particular religion is a valid one, then it is your duty. And this duty might be religious, might be rational. Okay. It is your duty to subscribe to that particular religion. So the validity here has got something to do with the idea of duty. So followers of religions are duty bound to subscribe to the valid religion of their time. This is the formula for the truth of religion. And here the idea of religious pluralism becomes even brighter. and becomes more understandable. Once you have got the whole issue of logical truth aside, and when you eliminated and eradicated the idea of logical truth, you will come to understand the idea of religious pluralism much better in the light of the validity and its relationship with the duty of the followers and the believers. So this is also your right. It is also your right, and it is your duty as well to subscribe and to believe in a valid religion. Now, can there be different and diverse valid religions in a particular time side by side? And this is the heart of the issue of religious pluralism. Of course, different truths, inconsistent truths, you cannot have at the same time. But is it the case? Can we claim philosophically that there can be different and diverse valid religions at the same time, side by side? Can there be such a thing? In the case of science, you cannot have different inconsistent theories side by side. In the case of philosophy, you cannot have inconsistent theories to take all these inconsistent as valid and as true. That is impossible in the case of science and philosophy. But what about in the case of religion? Oh yes, that is absolutely possible, because there we do not have problem of logical truth. We do not have the problem of logical inconsistency. We can claim that once you think that this particular religion is valid, then it is your duty to subscribe to it. Now, somebody else might come to the conclusion that a different religion is valid, then it is his duty to subscribe to that particular religion. So there might be different duties here, and these different duties can live together, a kind of coexistence of inconsistent duties towards different religions. That is the heart and the basis of religious pluralism. Inconsistency here and difference and diversity here will not actually be of any nuisance to us, will not annoy us, because here we do not deal with any logical problem. Inconsistent duties, different duties towards different religions, different religions of which we think that all of them are valid, is something which is quite logically possible, plausible, and in this particular sense we can have all of them, and they are quite compatible. Now, these are my, if you like, logical reasons for the possibility of religious pluralism. Now, you might ask me that since the title of the presentation of the lecture was Islam and Pluralism, now all what I said so far was, so to speak, extra religious. I did not base my discussion, my explanations, on any textual exegesis, on any inner religious or Islamic teaching. All I said was, so to speak, philosophical. And I tried to base my ideas, my arguments, on some epistemological positions. This is true. And this is actually the strength of the position, if you like. I do not want, and I have never attempted to base this particular issue on any inner religious teaching. Because in that case, I would have been bound by a particular religion, and that is not something to be useful here in this particular context. Yes, the arguments all are extra religious, is not based on any inner religious teaching, and that is the requirement, the logical requirement of the issue. And I think if we can establish it philosophically, then of course not only Islam but any other religion should and has to subscribe to it, should coordinate itself with this idea, And in a pluralistic world, we have to be a pluralistic Muslims or pluralistic Christians in the sense that we have to respect other religions and we have to be tolerant toward them. And we have to think that it is the duty of the Christians who think that Christianity is still a valid religion to be Christians. It is the duty, not only the right of the Christians, but the duty of Christians who find Christianity a valid religion to continue their Christianity and to be Christian so long as they think that Christianity is a valid religion. It is the duty of Muslims to remain Muslims, to stay Muslims, so long as they think that Islam is a valid religion. And the validity of religion, of Christianity, and the validity of Islam, and validity of Judaism, and all other religions are not inconsistent facts in a philosophical sense of the word. They are quite compatible, and it is not only the right, but their religious duty to stay as they are, so long as they think that their religion is valid. But of course, if they come to the conclusion that their religion is no longer valid, they have to. It is again their duty to change their religion and to be converted to whatever they think as valid. Now, another conclusion, another major consequence, which I would like to draw from the idea of religious pluralism, which is not theological. So far I have been a theologian, but now I would like to be a statesman, a politician for a very short time, and then of course I will terminate all this and stop the talking and invite our respectable audience to put forward their observations. Now, for a very short moment, let us think politically. Now, in a religious society such as ours in Iran, and there are many religious societies still in the third so-called third world, in a religious society, politics is inevitably religious. I mean, you may not like it, but it is a fact. People would like perhaps to separate religion from politics, to separate church from state. That is a different issue. But in a religious society, by the logic of the situation, politics and all other aspects of society will become tainted, colored by religion. So the state or politics will become inevitably religious. Now, in a religious society, despotism also will be a religious despotism. And in order to attack the political despotism, you have to attack the religious despotism. That is the formula. And that is the way to be paved towards democracy. A political despotism in a religious society is based on religious despotism. A political democracy is based on a religious democratic thinking. This is something which some of our intellectuals tend to ignore. They do not seem to be aware, or they do not seem to take this particular point seriously, attentively, that, it is not of a question whether we like religion or not, whether we like a religious society or not, but looking at the facts, we have to accept the idea that in a deeply religious society, all other affairs and respects and attributes of the society unavoidably will become religious, somehow or other, especially the politics of the society. Now, the despotism, as I said, stems from religious despotism. Therefore, in order to have a politically pluralistic society, you have to have a religious pluralism. The idea of religious pluralism should be fed into the mind of the believers. Once you have got religious pluralism, you will have a political pluralism in terms of democracy, in terms of different political parties, tolerance and all other consequences of pluralism. So these two go together. These two go hand in hand. In order to crush religion, the political despotism, you have to crush religious despotism. In order to have a political pluralism, you have to have a religious pluralism. Therefore, those theological arguments, which are quite valid, important, and strong in a theological sense of the word, they have got their own political fruits. They have got their own political fruits in the domain of politics and in a religious society. Of course, if you have got a secular society, that is a different story, and there you have to have perhaps different formulation, different solutions for your problems. But in a religious society, everything actually goes through religion and religious feelings and beliefs. And if you correct your understanding of religion and correct understanding of the believers of religion, if you modify it, if you reform it, if you base it on the idea of pluralism and the rest, then you will have your desirable political system. And this will be the end of my presentation. Thank you very much. I am looking forward to it.
I'm going to ask the first question. My privilege. Who is to say what is a religious society? Or whether a society is a religious society or not?
Well, there is no authority. This is an experimental, actually, issue. It is not something to be decided upon by mere... In Christian societies, the criterion is the number of the churchgoers and things like that. In societies such as ours, of course, going to mosque is not a strong criterion. I think, and I suppose myself, a believer, a devout believer, but maybe in 10 years I do not turn up in mosque, I mean even twice. So that is not the strong criterion. Therefore, we have to find some other things. I think when you look at schools, you look at universities, look at mosques, look at the legislation of the country, look at the parliament. In these places, I mean, you can find that the decision makings, the judgments of the people, the behavior of the people are being decided by religion and religious thinking or not. I am more familiar with our own society, our own country, and I am sure that we can consider the Iranian society as a deeply religious society. This I say it from my first-hand experience. I have got widespread connections with the students, with laymen, with different people in towns, in villages, and everywhere. And I think still religion has got a very strong hold on our people. And the issue or the idea of secularism is not an idea which has got a sure foot in our society. This is the thing now. In 10 years' time, in 50 years' time, nobody know it. So there is no authority, it is an experimental question, and it has to be decided upon through field investigations. And this kind of field investigation, I think I have done to some extent, and this is my answer.
Thank you very much. There's a question right in the back there.
Our ideas, I mean, the Islamic belief that the Prophet was the last messenger, the last prophet. And therefore, is it left for the two generations to the different interpretations from those and those with deep religious experiences to modify and interpret and so on? And would it not lead to extreme fluidity and misjudgment and misdirection?
But you mean the relationship of this the idea of the finality of the Prophet Islam with the issue of pluralism? You mean, actually, I mentioned it. since the idea of the truth of religions is not involved here, and also we only think about the validity of religion, therefore a Muslim can hold to the belief that his prophet was the seal of the prophets and was the final prophet. Nevertheless, he can think pluralistically in the field of religion, because it is based not on the truth, but on the validity of religion. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, this gentleman first, and then you.
You said that it is possible for different valid religions to coexist and different forms. Is it also desirable? That's question number one. And question number two is, in a religious society that you tell, when, where do the atheists stand if somebody doesn't believe in any valid religion?
Well, it is desirable, yes. As to the first question, it is desirable, yes, because diversity is the order of nature. Diversity is the order of nature. If you ask me, is it desirable for different cultures to stay different as they are, or is it desirable to reduce all of them into one single culture, I would definitely say that the plurality of cultures, the diversity of cultures, is very, very desirable indeed. And it is one of the main, it is in the nature of the human beings to be diverse. Therefore, it is no good to reduce them into one particular nature. So it is desirable, and in a sense, it is not only desirable for us, I think it has been desirable even in the eyes of God himself. And that is what I said, that he sent different prophets, and he already knew that the followers of these different prophets will never convert to one single religion. Therefore, I mean, this diversity is altogether desirable. Of course, if somebody comes to the conclusion that his religion is no longer valid, then it is his duty to convert. But it is a fact of history, as I said, that the bulk of the followers of the religions have stayed, I mean, as they have been since their birth, and they have not changed their religion. So there is a tendency, there is a stubbornness in all human beings to stay as they are, except for a few number of them. Now, as to the second question, atheists, of course, have got their own place in a religious society. It depends on the legislations, on the regulations, on the rules of religions. So far, of course, this has been the idea, not only in Islam but also in Christianity, in Judaism and elsewhere, that non-believers have got no place in the religious society, be it Christian or Muslim or whatever. And this was familiar to all. But in the modern time, the issue of the human rights has become so important, so prominent, that it is no longer considered as the duty of believers to believe in something, but it is now it is the right of the believers to believe in something. You know, we have come a very long way from duty to rights. Usually in the past, it was the dominant idea that it was the duty of the believers to be believers. But now the idea is this: it is the right of the believers to be believers. And since it is the right of the believers, somebody might not fulfill his right. Now, he might stay as an atheist. So in a particular religious society, with a pluralistic way of thinking, they should and they will tolerate atheists and non-believers. Yeah.
I would like to ask two questions on the chair, and that is, first of all, I must say that I don't speak Persian, but I will note one quotation. Prasnaviyo, Mayraviyo, Mohravi, Matta Purana, Dardamane, Pahana. How do you fit this couplet between the two polarities, positive and negative? Second question, very good one, about the politics, relationship of politics with the society, or racial mistakes. My own experience tells me that the definition of politics in the modern times is something like this. what an oddity politics is indeed. What an oddity politics is indeed. A cocktail of kufra iman indeed. One is the first indeed, one word, the last word indeed, two words. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, as to the first couplet you mentioned, I do not see any relationship between that and the pluralism which we were discussing here. That only says that the Masnavi of Maulavi is like Quran, but it is a Persian Quran rather than an Arabic Quran. That is the meaning of that couplet. This, of course, shows, demonstrates the eminence and the prominence of the Book of Rumi, not only for us Iranians, Persians, but also for the people in the subcontinent of India. And supposedly this verse belongs to Iqbal al-Lahuri. Of course, he was one of the main followers of Rumi. He respected him a lot and he learned a lot from him. So he says that Rumi's Masnavi is like Quran, but it is of course a Quran in Persian language rather than in Arabic. So yes, of course. Therefore, if you take Masnavi as Quran, you can base your ideas on it, and you can be sure that the followers of Quran and also followers of Rumi will accept your ideas. As to the second thing, well, this is your observation on politics. I do not quarrel with you, so, but I am sure that Machiavellism is the order of the day, and politics in the West and in the East, everywhere now, is under the influence of Machiavelli. And he was the best describer of the nature of the politics in the modern times. People do curse him, do reject him, do repudiate him, nevertheless they are intimate followers of him. And this is everywhere the case. So
So I very much agree with your comment that political democracy, especially in the third world, should be based on religious toleration. And in fact, I think it is important to note that in this country, in the 17th century, the greatest English philosopher, John Locke, was the proponent of both. In his article on religious toleration, he advocated, and that played a very influential role, of course, in the philosophers of the Enlightenment period in France and in America. But my question is this: do you think that religious toleration should be extended to heretic sects or heretic religions, for example, the Baha'is in Iran, or not?
Well, I mean, once we talk about religious pluralism, it includes all religions. We do not actually engage ourselves in theological issues as to the falsity or truth of any of these religions. You see, first of all, religion has got no definition, and I follow Cantwell Smith in this particular field, who says that we have got religions rather than religion. So there is no nature to religion. And so far as there are believers in a particular religion, they have to be tolerated in a religious society, and this is the logical requirements of the thesis of religious pluralism.
Yes.
Then what is the source of law in a religious society,
according to you? In a religious society, well, the source of the law are people, but since people are religious, therefore they, I mean, naturally base themselves on religious law. This is quite natural. It is not something to be ordered from high. It is not through any religious authority. It is because of the wish and the will of the people, if it is a religious society. And if it is not, then of course, then naturally again, they do not base their law on religion. Mind you, as the gentleman mentioned here, in the case of the Western society, the body of the society became secular in the first place, and then the state becomes secular, not vice versa. It is a mistake which is sometimes being made on the part of those who perhaps are not very well versed in the history of West. They think that it was the state that made the society secular, but it was not the case. The reverse was the truth. It was through thinkers, philosophers, scholars,
people were convinced as to the truth of secularism. They became indifferent, so to speak, towards religion. And therefore the state had to follow the society and to become secular and to separate church and state and so on. In a religious society, the state has to follow the society, has to reflect the ideas and the values of the people in the society. Therefore, inevitably and quite naturally, it will become religious and will base its regulations and law on the religion. And so far as the people are religious, the law will stay religious. And if they become different, then the law will become different accordingly.
Should I ask you a question? This discourse tonight implies a certain reference to new disciplines of knowledge. So many things are happening in modern day society today that will impact different communities, faith communities and others. To what extent do you see disciplines like social anthropology, literary criticism, sociology, and disciplines of those nature in looking at our tradition and looking at the future? And what methodology can we have to engender that type of a viewpoint in the Muslim world so that the discourse of the nature that we're having here today is not seen as being anti-religious? For us to be able to discourse these things, and we can still feel the comfort in our hearts that we are committed Muslims or committed to the faith. How can we engender that thought process among our religious scholars or in societies so that Muslim intellectuals can contribute to this debate in the Muslim world?
I know that in a religious society, talking like this is not is very expensive, is and you will be taxed, you see, accordingly. You know, of course, I suppose you are from Pakistan or perhaps from Africa, but I wanted to mention the example of Fazlur Rahman from Pakistan. You see, a passage in his whole work cost him all his job and career. And the passage actually was this, to the effect that perhaps Quran is at the same time the word of God and the word of the Prophet himself at the same time. So it cost him many things. So such kind of discourse, as you said, and it is quite true, might cost the speaker, whoever he is, a lot. Therefore, yes, it is true. But my answer very briefly to what you said is this. Yes. I do draw on social anthropology and on the modern epistemology and all that, and these are actually the main premises of the conclusion which I draw, though I may not mention all of them. And in order to get all these ideas across the people and not to be attacked by the believers as a non-believer, a kind of justice should be advocated. You see, justice so far has been either directed to the sources of wealth or to the sources of power. Now we have to direct the idea of justice to sources of information. So if we have got a plurality of the sources of information in religious society, and this I call it justice. Justice in the case of information, not only in the case of wealth, not only in the case of power, but also justice directed to the source of information. And even distribution of information in a religious society will pave the way and will provide a background for these kind of ideas in order to take ground and to get across the people evenly and to soften, to smooth down to some extent those attacks and those allegations which might come through the people who may not find these kind of ideas compatible with religiosity and sincere belief. Yeah.
Yes. I have one question back there. Yes.
This idea of religious pluralism derived from outside of religion, my question is, would it extend to tolerating at the second level a religion that does not agree with religious pluralism? And would you allow such a religion to thrive and prosper at the risk of your own extinction? Because that's only where the problems lie.
This is a question which is quite similar to the question that does the idea of liberty, of freedom, extend to the point that even the people who do not like the idea or perhaps oppose the idea of freedom, should they be free or not? Well, here we have got the same contradiction. This is called the contradiction of pluralism, contradiction of democracy, contradiction of freedom. All these sort of contradictions, you know, has been discussed in the political theory. Here, I mean, in theory, yes. In theory, yes. I would say that pluralism is an umbrella which has to be extended and expanded even to those people who do not like the idea, who may oppose the idea, and who are perhaps trying decidedly to topple the idea. In theory, this is the logical requirement of the theory. But in practice, we do not deal with reasons. We do deal with causes. And these are two different fields which has to be kept separate in order not to commit the fallacy and not to fall in the trap of the contradiction I mentioned before. Not to fall in the trap of the contradiction. In theory, if the people who are advocates, who are supporters of religious pluralism are strong enough, they will not allow the opponents to topple them and to extinguish them. This is in practice. Therefore, in practice, you have got forces acting in the field. They are not reasons, they are not thoughts and ideas, they are forces acting in the field of pluralism. But of course, in the field of theory, yes, yes, people who do believe in freedom, do believe in liberty, do believe in pluralism, should tolerate the enemies of pluralism, enemies of freedom, and enemies of liberty. But if they are strong enough, they can tolerate their enemies as well, and they accommodate them even. And perhaps sometimes they might convince them and convert them to their party. So please keep separate the field of reasons and the field of causes. That is the foundation of... Pardon?
By forcible means?
No, no, no. If they are strong enough, this does not mean by forcible means. If they are strong enough to defend their position.
Intellectually.
Intellectually and practically, both. Practically, if they are numerous enough, if their numbers is big enough, therefore they are quite strong. That is the main thing. After all, in a religious society, I am not saying that we have to defend by force the religion, but if the religious people are strong enough in their belief and in their number, so the society is religious. And that is this. Non-religious and non-believers can be tolerated, can be accommodated, and there will be no fear of their existence in that society. Yeah. So in practice and in reality, we deal with causes rather than reasons. This I am insistent on, and I invite you to contemplate, to reflect on it. Yes.
Professor, on one hand you emphasized on religious plurality. On the other hand, when we looked at the non-believers, there is no place for them in any society, whether it be religious society or even a secular society is a very current concept. So, if you look at religion, it is really for human beings to attain what they want to, quote-unquote, salvation, if you may say. But it is not for the recognition of God. God doesn't need recognition. It's human beings who need his recognition to achieve what they want to. So why can't there be a place for non-believers? Because they're not doing any harm to God. You know what I'm saying? There is a contradiction there, I see. That on one hand we encourage plurality, and on the other hand, non-believers do not have any place in the society.
Who says non-believers do not have any place in society?
Well,
they have got a place in nature, therefore they have got a place in society. After all, they have been created by God, they are being nurtured by God.
Yes, so, but you said that this was a modern phenomenon of human rights where we have taken it to such an extent where they have their position in the religious society. Even now, if you go to developing world, it will still not be tolerated.
if you're a disbeliever.
Oh yes, if if they tolerated them, they we would not have such discussions. All these discussions are in order for the religious society to think more pluralistically. Of course, after all, this is the point of this discussion. This is not a solved problem. We are talking like this, and we are introducing these ideas in order to get the idea of tolerance across the people, in order to make them more tolerant towards non-believers and towards people who think differently. That is the whole point of these debates.
One question. Then here and then there.
Sir, going back to rights and duties, as a practicing Christian, we have this right to practice our faith, as do the Muslims and the Jews. But as a father, I'd have a duty to protect my son, and I have a duty to bring him up in the Christian faith, because as a foundation, I think on all our religions, we have that duty to bring children into God's family. This pluralism, though, detracts from my duty to protect my child in what I believe is right, and in what I believe, or what a Muslim may believe, or what a Jew may believe, in what is right. And accepting pluralism, we have to knock away that protection that we're trying to build up for our kids, in which our religion actually dictates that we should be. This, you know, safeguarding of our, keeping it pure and bringing our children up in it. So how can you, on the one hand, you know, align religious pluralism without detracting from these equally valid religions?
No, so long as you think that it is your duty to bring up your child according to your own beliefs and convictions, then you have to do it.
Why
it doesn't? I mean, when your child is mature enough, then he will decide, or she will decide, what kind of religion he will choose for himself or for herself. So, I mean, here again, we have got the idea of cause and reasons. You see, people, when they are immature, they do not work or according to reasons. I mean, their ability to choose and to understand and to choose from among different arguments is still very weak, so they cannot do it. So they need somebody to give them, to offer them the opportunity just to know something, or perhaps to have a particular conviction. But when they are mature enough, mentally as well as physically, then of course it is their turn to find and to choose whatever they like. Then and there, of course, we should not bar them from choosing. And that, of course, will be inconsistent with pluralism. But so long as they are children, no, it is the duty of the parents to guide them. Such as you guide them in matters of health, education, also you have to guide them in matters of religious education and the rest.
In the distinction that you made in theoretical reason and practical reason, or causation
is a better word, yes.
I was reminded of the question that was asked at the back about, therefore, what would be the source of law in what you call a religious society of the type that you advocate. And it seems that on theoretical grounds, following your last answer, that in fact the law theoretically should be secular law. However, for practical reasons, one may accede to religious law, for example, a sort of law that would ban people wearing the dress of their choice. One would accede to that on practical grounds, because one has no other choice. But theoretically, therefore, in your type of religious society, one would still be erecting, in fact, a secular constitution, precisely in order to be able to mediate and recognize religious differences, so that theoretically your position is identical to one advocated by a liberal secularist. Is that?
In liberalism, you look at religion as something, I mean, not divine, anyway, something which is there, of course, a fact of history, considered by some people as divine, but you are indifferent towards it, and you, of course, leave people free to choose whatever religion they want. And of course, atheism and non-belief are on a par with theism and belief and so on and so forth. So this is the position in liberalism. In a religious society, and in my definition, a religious society is a society in which the majority of the people are sincerely religious. Not by force, not because of the authority, not because of the law, and not because of the legislations. The majority of the people are sincerely religious, are sincere believers. This is the religious society, okay? Now, in this society, a democratic rule requires that the values of the people be respected on the part of the state. A democratic rule requires that the values of the people, which are of course religious values, are to be respected on the part of the state. So here you have got religion, you have got your sincere believers, and you have got the rules of the religion which is practiced by the people, and people are really content and happy with religious laws being ruling over the society, because they sincerely do believe in it. The problem arises when this religiosity weakens and becomes feeble, and or perhaps when the majority of the people are no longer religious, sincere believers. There, of course, you have got the problem, and there you have to leave it to the people to choose which way they would like to be ruled over. So the legitimacy, what I'm saying is this, the legitimacy of the law comes from the people, does not come from any religious authority. That is the delicate difference between a religious rule and a rule in a religious society. This is the subtle difference. The legitimacy does not come from any religious authority, does come from the religious people, the bulk of the society. But since they are religious, naturally the law will become religious.
Pursue this one step further, because I think it's important. So is it not what you just said leads us to the distinction between liberalism and democracy? That what you're basically saying, if it comes from the people, if fascism arises from the people, therefore the constitutional rights associated with liberalism could be trampled upon, could be set aside in a democratic way. In other words, as Hayek says, democracy is not opposed to totalitarianism. It's liberalism that's opposed to totalitarianism. So the question here becomes this. If you shift legitimacy from clerical authority to popular authority, you still are faced with the problem of the extent and the depth of the populist feelings. And if the populist feels that atheists should have no right, then you're faced with a problem. And hence,
Of course,
the whole argument.
Yes, so, definitely we will face a problem, but that is against the issue of causes rather than reasons. We may not like the feeling of the people, but the feeling of the people sometimes may become so strong that might force you to legislate what they would like. So here, we may not like it as individuals, but looking at the society in bulk, that will happen, and nobody can actually resist it. So you see, again, on the one hand, we have got our own ideas and wishes and feelings and values and criteria, and on the other hand, we have got forces, social forces, acting, I mean, presently in the field. So if the social forces are so strong that, according to you, people want fascism, then inevitably the society will be fascistic. We may not like it, but that will happen.
The problem moves into the field of politics.
That's right. That's right.
Absolutely, we are agreeing.
Yeah. Politics means theory of power. Wherever you have got the power, you have got the politics. That's right. Yeah, this is something which I sometimes say, that when they say that Islam is political, this means that Islam is, if it is strong, then it will become political. It cannot help it, I mean. Wherever you have got power, wherever you have got a powerful body, a powerful community, it will become a source of politics. That is inevitable. I mean, if Christianity is not political, that is because it is not powerful in these countries. If it gets very powerful, it will have its own say in the field of politics. So beware, okay? And fasten your seat belts.
What do you mean by the authentic interpretation of the text? And who will decide, which particular interpretation is valid and which is not?
By authentic interpretation of the text, I mean those interpretations which comply with the criteria. But who is the decision maker as to which interpretation is the authentic? That is the community of experts. This is like the case of science, the case of philosophy. We have got no higher authority in science, in religion, in philosophy, nowhere. We have got only the community of specialists, community of scientists, community of philosophers and so on, community of scholars. Therefore, the community of scholars, actually, this is, again, I know, take the idea from, as you know, Thomas Kuhn, who talked a lot about the community of the scientific community. Really, that is the higher authority. And it is not a higher authority to be imposed on the community. It is a natural product of the progress of science. Therefore, in the community of the experts or specialists, it is decided which interpretation is to be considered as authentic and which is not. And that is the final thing. And as you know, since the community of specialists is changing, therefore, the decision as to the authenticity of an interpretation will change. And this has precedent in science. You know that theories were refuted in the past and then were rehabilitated later on by the community of scientists. This is something which happens all the time. Therefore, one interpretation, we might reject it now, and it will be reaccepted and re-entered into the community later on. So this is something which is inevitable, and that will happen. But the higher authority, as I said, is the community of experts, of scholars. This is, in continuation of what I said to you, this means that once we enter the area of interpretations, we will have no longer any authority whatsoever. This is one of the major consequences of my position. You see, if you separate, if you keep religion and the interpretation of religion separate from each other, religion itself will become, so to speak, inaccessible. All we reach and all we attain will be a possible interpretation. And interpretation is always human. It is not divine. It is not sacred. It is not holy. Therefore, it is refinable, it is criticizable, it is redefinable, it is refutable, and all that. It has got all characteristics of any human product. Therefore, there also you have the community of experts to decide upon the authenticity or validity of the interpretation, rather than a higher religious authority. So here, in the case of the interpretation of religion, we face the same condition as we face in the case of science, in the case of philosophy, and so on.
Yes, two more questions.
Two more questions, yes, no.
One, two. During the course of this conversation, you base the theory, the religio-political theory, on epistemological presentations, yet we can see some ontological explanations seeping through. For instance, when you mentioned that, after all, it was God's decision to have multiple, for instance, or various prophets sent down to people. Now, this to me sounds like the argument is based on some assumptions which are not commensurable among faith communities, and it's more monotheistic. Is there a reason for you to include that in your presentation? Why should you say that God decided to have?
No, not really. I do not invest much on that particular argument. It was just, by the way, that I mentioned it. I do not base my view and my conclusion on that particular premises. But mind you, that is something which is accepted, if not by all religions, but it's a consensus among the believers of at least monotheistic religions. That this has been the case.
Did you mean to appeal to the belief of the religious community that is?
It is at least appealing to the believers of the divine or so-called heavenly religions. At least, though, as I said, I do not invest much on that particular. Nevertheless, it has got its own place in the case of the believers who do believe in one of these monotheistic religions: Judaism, Zoroastrianism, Islam, Christianity. And mind you, they have got a huge fellowship in the world, so, yeah.
One question.
You've given us a definition of a religious society as one in which the majority are sincerely religious.
Yeah.
How do you measure sincerity?
If I were the authority to say which society is religious and which is not, then your question would have some place to be asked. I am not the authority to say. This is by way of definition. Definitions always has to be precise. But decisions and instantiation, in the sense that to show which society is the instance of that particular definition, has got its own separate criterion. Of course, as I said, when it comes to the laws of family, of education, in the case of the laws of political things and so on, there of course you can see the degree of the sincerity of the people. It is a matter of degree. It is not to be decided by any particular body, any particular committee, and I think it is something which you can feel it when you live in a particular society. It is not something to be gained and attained through some objective criteria. You know, in the case of the human societies, this role of objectivity is very, very limited. Here, of course, you have to be a member, an element of the society, in order to feel the sincerity or otherwise of the people. Therefore, I leave it to the members of the society, to the informants among the people in the society, to decide upon it. And there also, and again, we have got a community of experts, of specialists, of informants, rather than a single particular higher authority to decide on this very sophisticated issue.
Well, I hope you'll join me in thanking Dr. Sarouche for a most illuminating presentation.